You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
There are monsters all over the world. In every culture, we humans paint the canvas of shadows with the palette of fear and wonder. Even in Japan, a country that has reinvented itself as a showcase of modernity and technology, the folklore of monsters is culturally significant and remarkably diverse. There, they're known as yokai, and you'll hear more about them next on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long, bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and in this episode, Ben Radford and I will be interviewing Matt Ault and Hiroko Yoda about their book, Yokai Attack, The Japanese Monster Survival Guide. But first, a couple of bits of housekeeping. Monster Talk is proud to announce that we won the 2012 Parsec Award for Best Fact Behind the Fiction Podcast. This was our third nomination and our first win, and we're delighted. Ben and I accepted in person at the award ceremony, which is held each year at DragonCon. Our submission for the award was an excerpt from episode number 41. If you haven't listened to that one, you should. It's a doozy. It's called The Big Bad Wolf. Also, our co-host, Dr. Karen Stolzno, is getting married to Rocky Mountain paranormal investigator Matthew Baxter this week. So congratulations! Hopefully, they'll have a lovely wedding, a lovely honeymoon, and she'll get back in front of a Monster Talk microphone where she belongs. Now on to our interview.
Monster Talk.
So today we're talking to Hiroko Yoda and Matt Ault, a husband and wife team who run a translation company, as well as writing books on monsters and ninja. Matt was previously on episode 30, Unmasking the Ninja. And today we're discussing a new edition of his book, Yokai Attack, The Japanese Monster Survival Guide. If, you know, since we talked, a lot of stuff has happened. The Fukushima disaster happened, and I saw you. I didn't see you. I guess I heard you on CNN covering that. How are things going with that?
Yeah, it was a pretty hectic time for a little while there, more than a little while. I mean, things have only really just started getting back to normal now. Nothing like a massive natural and man-made disaster to kind of throw a little spice in the thing, so to speak. And it was just a huge tragedy all around. But fortunately, things are getting back to normal now.
Good.
Yes.
All right. So let's get on to something a little more light. So what are yokai? And how are they different from Japanese monsters we are more familiar with here in America, like Godzilla and then J-horror movies and Pokemon?
Well, first of all, monsters like Godzilla or the giant dudes who Ultraman fights, or those kind of monsters who we associate with as Japanese monsters in the West, are known as kaiju in Japanese. And that word, actually, a lot of people in America, a lot of monster fans know it as well. But kaiju is generally the word used for giant monsters that stomp on cities and stuff like that.
It has its own word. I love that.
Yeah.
And also, those are characters. It's copyrighted, it is that somebody owns it. But yokai, on the other hand, they are coming from Japanese traditions or oral traditions, that sort of things.
And nobody, folklore,
yes, exactly.
Exactly. The difference between Godzilla and, say, a leprechaun, you know, or Godzilla and an elf or something like that.
Okay.
You know,
all right.
They are basically yokai, in a nutshell, I guess you could say, are like superstitions with personalities, because they are the things that in times of old Japanese people came up with to explain the strange happenings in the natural world around them that couldn't be explained with science, because science hadn't come to Japan at that time, or anywhere else for that matter.
Okay. That's a good description. I like the way you put that. I was looking through your book not only this afternoon but over the last couple of days, and I just love the format. It's, you know, these really interesting illustrations and sort of almost Dungeons and Dragons like characteristics and things like that. And it was just interesting sort of seeing all the varieties of monsters. And, you know, I'm fairly familiar with monsters around the world, although I probably had only heard of maybe a half dozen of these. And I was really intrigued to sort of see how in-depth you go into these. But one thing I noticed as I was reading through them is that, with a few exceptions, like the Nekomata, the two-tailed cat, or the Nurikabe, the huge black wall, most yokai seem to be anthropomorphic. They have human, arms and legs and features and things like that. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, Japan has a long tradition of what is called animism. And I'm not sure if you know what that means off the top of your head, but it's basically a belief that anything, not just people or animals, anything, even like a rock or a tree, can have a soul. And because of this way of looking at the world, basically, anything was fair game to be anthropomorphized or personified. And that's why you see so many yokai that take the form. There are even yokai that take the form of everyday objects that have faces and hands and feet, like old discarded sandals or umbrellas or things like that. So that kind of anthropomorphic nature of a lot of yokai is, I think, really key to what makes them different from supernatural creatures abroad.
I know it sounds strange, but it's not really strange, because imagine you have a favorite skis, a pair of skis that, you bought them, like, say, 5 or 6 years ago, and it's pretty much old. You know, your friends, and you probably started making fun of them because it's out of I don't know, the styles or whatever, but still you feel like the pair of skis, your favorite. And then you started the kind of personifying it. And then, so imagine that, okay, the pair of skis is broken and you have to throw them away. But, you feel kind of tingling, hurting feeling, because it's your favorite, it's just, you have so much memories to it. And that's where the yokai are coming from. You start, it's not just a pair of ski, it's your favorite ski, which spend a lot of time with you. And then that's the yokai's, it's partially about.
Yeah. And there's another, no, it's good. That's actually really good. And there's another example of this kind of animism that even people in the West do. There's a lot of people out there who, when they're walking in the room and they stub their toe on a chair or something like that, will then kick the chair kind of out of anger. Mm-hmm. Why would you do that? I mean, if you believe that chair has absolutely no, will of its own, why would you punish it by kicking it, And
well, I was in a friend of mine's car a couple months back, and his car was dying, and he was trying to get it started, and he reaches over and starts stroking lovingly the dashboard as if he just pets the dashboard, then suddenly, the transmission will kick in. It's just weird, the sort of personification. So I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, I know. But I have family members who name their car, so, yeah, I get it.
Right. Well, the military names all of its ships. They call them by female, a ship is always a she or a her. A lot of aircraft had kind of names, especially during World War II and things like that, that were names and faces associated with them. So this kind of idea of personifying physical things in the world around you that obviously aren't alive is, although the yokai are kind of the most extreme example of this, it's certainly not limited to Japan. And that's one of the things we tell people when we're talking about them.
Do the yokai have a place in Shinto tradition, or are they kind of separate?
Separate.
Okay.
Yes. those are more, like you said, pointed out that folklore things. It's not directly related to Shinto or anything like that.
But that said, there's a strong animistic component to Shinto, where Shinto is very much about worshiping the natural world and paying respect to. There are all sorts of deified trees or deified waterfalls or deified caves and places like that in Shinto. So there's no direct overlap, but there's certainly a lot of conceptual overlap.
Because imagine that a pair of glasses, right now, like if you started losing your eye vision, and all you have to do is buy a contact lens or the pair of glasses. That's a technology. And then so in Japan, in the shrine area, actually there's a memorial for a pair of glasses.
Yeah, used eyeglasses.
Used eyeglasses. Just because, with that pair of glasses, you want to be able to do anything. You're just basically blind. And then
so just like
Matt said that in Shinto, the people, Japanese people, appreciate surroundings. Well, yes, we appreciate surroundings because without sun, no crops will grow. Or without rain, the crops will die. Things like that. It's just people cannot live alone. And then we show the respect and then the appreciations to the environment. And that's the idea. So that I know that yokai are not directly related to Shintoism, but that kind of concept. The appreciations, it's totally shared.
What can you tell us about the history of yokai as a field of study? As you're mentioning, it sort of goes back to folklore and mythology, but the whole idea that folklore and mythology are subjects that are inherently worthy of academic study is actually a fairly new concept. So what can you tell us about the history of people looking at it as a particular field and not just sort of as beliefs?
Well, I think it's really interesting that the first person to ever put a lot of yokai stories down, put pen to paper, was actually not a Japanese person. He was a foreigner by the name of Lafcadio Hearn, who was married to a Japanese woman here in Japan at the turn of the 20th century, the late 1800s and the early 1900s. And he was a big fan of the occult. He had actually been married to a voodoo priestess in New Orleans in the late 1800s, which must have caused a scandal, a white man and an African American getting married in the Deep South in the 1800s was, to put it mildly, not mainstream at all. But after they separated, he spent some time in Martinique and a lot of places like that, and eventually made his way to Japan, where he married a Japanese woman and started hearing about all sorts of yokai stories, ghost stories, supernatural stories, and wrote a book called In Ghostly Japan. And it was the first time that anybody had ever, for Japanese people, stories about kappa or stories about tengu or stories about ghosts nobody wrote them down because there was no need to. Everybody knew what they were. Everybody, if you mentioned them, people could finish your sentence because these were just part and parcel of Japanese oral tradition and culture. But to Lafcadio Hearn, they were very new, and he wrote them down. And when that book was translated into Japanese a few years later, it ironically kicked off the entire folklore studies field in Japan, which was picked up by other scholars who sort of ran with that ball. And now it's a very respected field here in Japan.
So you wrote that Dr. Inryo Inoue developed Yokai Gaiku to catalog and debunk these creatures. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what he was like and what his writing was like?
Well, he's an interesting individual. He actually known as anti-supernatural things, anti-yokai, anti-ghost. He basically tried to prove that yokai don't exist or ghosts don't exist. But the thing is that it's so obvious that he loves those things. He has a mixed feeling. I don't know how to explain it.
Well, what Hiroko is saying is because he kept such detailed records on each one of these things that, ironically, even though he is seen as and known as Dr. Yokai, the man who set out to debunk superstition across Japan and succeeded to a large extent, he's actually, you could compare him to a James Randi or something like that, who's dedicated to kind of dispelling myths of superstitions and things like that. In spite of that, he actually dutifully recorded all of these myths. So records are ironically one of the strongest records a lot of people that we have today of what people believed back then.
Right. So actually there is a park created by Dr. Inoue in Nakano. But the park, it's still, you can go there today. Anyway, it's a really strange park because there's a tree, willow tree. I forget which tree, what kind of a tree that was. But anyway, he actually brought that tree because everybody believed that there's a ghost under the tree. So he brought the haunted tree and planted in the park. And he's trying to prove that there's no ghost in the tree. It's so strange thing. So that really attracts a lot of people. And so he's a very interesting and a famous individual in a weird sort of way.
I'm definitely going to have to read more about him. He sounds like a man after my own heart. That's how I am. I'm very skeptical, but I love monster folklore. I love it.
Put him against this background that Japan was like this feudal country until 1860, until 1868. A few years before that, the Americans sailed in and basically opened Japan. It had been this kind of closed off kingdom that nobody could enter or leave. And they so rapidly modernized that basically these scientific concepts and these yokai concepts were existing together at the same time in history in a way that you didn't see so much in the West, where where modernization was more of a gradual process. So that's where he came in to try to kind of be a proponent of science while debunking this sort of thing in the background.
In your book, you talk about as I recall, you mentioned the fact that the first yokai drawings, if I'm not mistaken, were actually depicted in service of like a satire, right? Some sort of like social satire. What's that about?
Yeah, there's a great artist by the name of Toriyama Sekien, who was active around the mid-1770s. We like to say around the same time George Washington was being elected president, is when his first book came out. And at the time in Japan, Japan had a very active printing industry as far back as the early 1700s. And at that time in Japanese history, encyclopedias were very popular. Compilations of Chinese herbs, compilations of animals, kind of early biological texts, early grammatical texts and things like that. And as a parody of that, Toriyama Sekien created the world's first yokai encyclopedia by gathering all sorts of information from his friends and people he knew and from the countryside. And he's the first person to ever actually draw what they looked like, quote unquote. So his illustrations of them really influence what people think of various yokai, what they look like. His illustrations are basically where that all comes from today.
How well known are these yokai legends even in modern Japan? Are they still fairly commonly told, or is it more historical now?
A very common subject. Actually, if you ask, you just pick one Japanese person walking on the street and ask and say, "Do you know yokai?" They will answer yes, 100%. It's so popular. But I don't know the depth of the knowledge. The depth of knowledge is of course different from individual.
Sure.
Definitely, from the kids to old, they know kappa. They know tengu. There's certain yokai which we cover at the very beginning part. Definitely, they know. That's actually one of the reasons why we decided to create the English version of a yokai book, because in Japan, yokai is so popular. But once you step out of Japan, nobody knows what it is. And so that's actually one of the main reasons why we created this book, Yokai Attack.
So in addition to the folklore aspect, how many people do you think believe in them?
I don't know. See, the question is belief is a right to ask, because, so do you believe in ghosts?
Well, yeah, which may be different from are you scared of one, which is a different thing. You know, I get it.
Yeah, but kids are scared. But, but still, the being scared and being scared and also being entertained are a really fine line.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of kids say, "Oh, I'm so scared of yokai." But after that, they say, "Oh, I love this yokai, because da 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 da." Many of myself, I love yokai ever since I was a little girl. I grew up with those things, and I know I'm not special. It just Yokais are fun things. That's what we see.
They're like the original characters. You know, every mascot that you see on a Japanese, you know, product, every Pokemon, every, you know, even in science fiction anime and things like that, the portrayals of giant robots and all sorts of other creatures that all owe a really huge debt to the yokai, which are really Japan's first characters in an era before mass media existed.
I have to say, after reading your book, a lot of the video games and anime I've seen seem less crazy or less, I mean, just, I don't know what the right word is, so different than anything I've seen before, because some of these concepts really fit in better with knowing the folklore aspect of it. You mentioned in the book some of Studio Ghibli. Is that how you say that? I always,
Yes.
Studio Ghibli seemed influenced by yokai, especially, like, I didn't know that, you know, Mononoke meant ghosts. So that the Princess Mononoke story seems very influenced by this, if I'm reading it right.
You know, it's interesting because Mononoke doesn't mean ghost. They translated it that way because there was no way to really translate that word. And Mononoke is really a yokai. It's another way of saying yokai, and yokai are very different from ghosts because a ghost is a someone, right? That's somebody who has passed away and has decided to not shuffle off this mortal coil for whatever reason. So a ghost is a someone, but a yokai is a something, and they're actually like minor gods in a lot of cases. There is some overlap between the two, but if you take that someone versus something, you can kind of start to see that basically if you look at Mononoke Hime, there aren't any ghosts in that. They're all dealing with these spirits that live in the woods and these spirits that live in the mountains and these spirits that are these deities, these natural deities. And what basically people lose when technology starts to eat into our natural resources. So actually, I think Ghost Princess is not a good translation of the title of that film, although I understand why they did it. It's really more like Yokai Princess.
Yeah, and I think the Spirited Away maybe even captured it better as far as the way that they're kind of gods, kind of demons.
Yes.
Really, really cool movies. If our listeners haven't seen those, they should totally get them.
No, Mononoke Hime is a great, great film. We really like Spirited Away, too. And actually, My Neighbor Totoro is very yokai-like.
Yeah.
He's referred to as a god in the actual film itself. But really, his treatment is extremely yokai-like. And I don't think you can even really fully appreciate Ghibli's films unless you understand a little bit about Japanese folklore and mythology.
When I was reading through the book, there was one particular one that jumped out at me. And that's partly because of my background in urban legends, and that was the Kuchisake Anna.
Yes.
And it seems to have like really strong elements of modern urban legend. Can you tell us more about that? It's just so cool.
Yeah. Well, the Kuchisake Anna, I would say, is the last yokai we created. In other words, the most modern yokai we have. Well, she was very popular during the 70s when I was in elementary school. That obviously there's no internet, so it's a pure the oral what's it called? Basically, it's just straight entire Japan. It's a mass hysteria. Mm-hmm. So we don't know where that the origin. We don't know. We have no idea where that woman came from, but it's just. People start talking about it.
But for those who don't know, because I've read it, so I have some idea. But tell us what the story is about it, and then tell us more about it.
Yeah, the Kuchisake Onna is as Hiroko is saying, the Kuchisake Onna is one of Japan's most recent yokai, and basically she takes the form of a very normal looking woman who is wearing a surgical mask, which actually sounds strange in the West because we don't walk around in the street with surgical masks, but it's very common in Asia. When you have a cold or there's cold season going around, just as an etiquette sort of thing, to wear a gauze surgical mask around outside. So that in and of itself isn't that strange. But what she does is she basically haunts the paths that kids take to elementary school. And when she encounters a kid or when a kid runs into her, she asks the kid, "Do I look pretty?" And if the kid answers yes, Then she peels off her mask to reveal a mouth that is stretches from ear to ear with hundreds of sharp fangs in there and says, "Do I still look pretty?" And if answer yes again, she pulls out a knife and cuts your mouth just like hers. And if you answer no, she stabs you to death anyway.
So anyway,
I love it. This is so cool.
Anyway, there is a background story. Well, so the background story was, well, the woman went to the dentist. And then the dentist was quack. And then so he hurt her. It was his mistake during the oral surgery or whatever. And then it flashed it. So that really traumatized her, quote unquote. And then also, so one of the techniques that the kids can run away from her or at least scare her, it's called pomado. What is
hair
pomado?
Hair pomade. You know, like it's a precursor to hair gel or hair mousse.
Okay.
Okay, but that smells so bad. That I don't know today the pomado smells bad or anything, but it's the 70s. The pomado smells very so oily. Anyway, so if you encounter slash mouth woman, say pomado three times. And she will be scared and run away because she was traumatized by the dentist, which has a lot of pomado. So we have no idea, but that kind of background stories were just like spread out entire Japan. Like another example is like the woman is driving the red.
Yeah, she's supposed to be. And so you might think to yourself, okay, well, what if I just run away really fast, right? Well, it turns out that the Kuchisake Onna is like faster than an Olympic sprinter. She's fast. And so, okay, well, what if I'm like the number one kid on my sports team? Like, I can probably outrun her. Well, actually, she's been sighted driving a Lamborghini too. And will drive you down if you try to run away. So, like, you can see this kind of, there's all these key elements in here. Kids are afraid of dentists, a lot of them. You know, and, you know, kids are obviously afraid of monsters. So there's a lot of kind of different elements in here that all combine in this perfect storm to create this really amazing character.
Right. So it's just, and also those are, you know, we are talking about the kids here. So the kids start talking and say, you know, my friend's sister heard a story, you know, that she saw the slash mouse woman kind of thing. And then it was just. It was really amazing mass hysteria.
Yeah. Well, like the telephone game.
Yeah, exactly. Telephone game.
You know?
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I'd seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, it's classic friend of a friend folklore urban legend material. I mean, it's just pristine. I mean, I'm frankly surprised someone hasn't already made, you know, a horror film about it. I could just picture the storyboards right now. Were there any reports in newspapers of anybody actually seeing her, or was it all just friend of a friend? You know, my cousin's best friend's, you know, hairdresser told me.
It's the answer is the last one. It just nobody saw her. It just I heard somebody and that kind of things. But still, it was good enough to cause hysteria. So the kids started freaking. Some of the school actually canceled the class because the kids are just scared. They go to school, or the school principal, right? They actually issued. I don't know the rules to go home in a group, I heard that the police actually get the free hysteric phone call that I saw /woman. Can I go home? Can you come home with me? Kind of thing. And then the police actually escorted some of the kids. It was. So that kind of stuff was just,
So there were reports about the phenomenon. There were reports about the phenomenon, but there's a couple interesting things about this, one of which is that you can kind of see almost in real time how a yokai developed. You know, and you can imagine back in time, this very similar process was at work, where, one person would tell one person, another person, and then, it would get kind of a little bit, oh, maybe I misheard it a little bit. It would get exaggerated because that's just how people are, and by the end of it, what had been probably a very minor incident had mutated into this crazy monster that actually does start affecting real life. Because if kids are calling the cops and need them to escort them home, or schools are canceling classes, this is actually an example of yokai really having an effect on the real world. And it's kind of an interesting phenomenon that way.
Yeah, that is cool. I'm always fascinated by those stories where you have essentially in what in folklore they call ostension, where something is sort of taken based in a folkloric setting. For example, the Bloody Mary, saying Bloody Mary three times in front of mirrors, basically people enacting folklore related events. So that's kind of cool. And what the Kuchisaka reminded me of was the La Llorona story, which I've wrote a book chapter on recently, where there's stories, this the weeping woman who drowned her children, and it's primarily in Mexico and other places in the Southwest, but there are stories about that she's a young, she's this young beautiful woman, and a man will go up to her and sort of proposition her, and when she turns around, what used to be a young beautiful woman is this horrific, skull faced woman, and of course they freak out and run around. So
that's a huge yokai like story. I mean, right there in a nutshell, and it's interesting because these yokai, their expression as characters is uniquely Japanese, but the terror and the fear that they tap into is not uniquely Japanese. We all share that. And that's the reason why I think everybody can appreciate yokai. Because once you're explained a little bit of what their background is, you're like, oh man, yeah, I'd have been scared by that too, And so there's this kind of essential humanity to all of these stories. Whether it's that one you're just talking about a woman losing her child and turning into a creature, or kids afraid to commute home on the way from school. I mean, that's scary if you're only 6 years old,
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that story actually reminded me more of Onibaba, because didn't she killed her babies and then became a wandering monster, right? Isn't that her origin?
Onibaba is a creature, a yokai, who cuts the livers out of unborn fetuses. She kind of preys on pregnant women traveling on the roads in old Japan. And, back in time, before highways and subway systems and things like that, you had to walk everywhere. And even if you were pregnant, even if you were a kid, even if you were, handicapped, physically handicapped, and there was all sorts of things that could happen to you out in the wilderness, in between towns, which were kind of a lawless zone in Japan, even up to the 1800s or so. So it's very easy to see how people would talk about things that happen to travelers, whether they had fallen to some natural fate or whether they, somebody had attacked them. But there's no explanation for it, and it's very easy to see how stories of creatures out in the wilderness could spread.
Sorry, go ahead.
The good thing about the yokai is that yokai is not really your enemy. You brought the case of Onibaba, I'm gonna just make it kind of talk about it further a little bit. It sounds like she is a, the cold blood murderer, But on the background story is that she was actually ordered by a higher up people, and then she was actually basically trying to save some princess or something like that, because back in time, and people believed that the organ part of the fetus, unborn fetus, was a great medicine to cure the princess disease. So her hands, to make the story short, her hands were tied, so she had to do it, but she could do it. But finally, she did it. She found a pregnant woman, and it killed a woman, and it got the organ out, an unborn fetus. But later she found out, actually, the woman she killed, she just killed, was her daughter, who she was split a long time ago. Because of her economic situation, so it's a sad story right there.
And I misremembered it, and that's why I remembered her killing her daughter, but I forgot that there was the other component. Sorry.
So anyway, so that's the yoga is a good part. It's just not enemy. It's just something. It's always sad story or there's something that you can really share. It's just cold blood. Murder, but if I were her, well, then what I would do, that kind of things. It makes you think, a little bit further. It's just like, it's just rather than just, the enemy or bad or.
Yeah. So I had a question about the word Oni itself, because I'd heard it translated as demon. Is that the right? I mean, there's more than one kind of Oni, or am I misremembering that too?
Demon, the thing about demon is, like so many things in Japanese folklore, they're kind of tough to pin down. Like, demon is correct in a limited sense, in the sense that, yes, when you go to hell in the Buddhist tradition, you are, or the underworld, I guess you should say, because it's a little bit different from Judeo-Christian versions of hell, your punishment is meted out by Oni, or Oni-like creatures. So from that standpoint, yes, they're demons. But they're also, Oni, in a kind of folkloric standpoint, aren't demons. They're more like a stand-in, a personification of power beyond human comprehension, power beyond our ability to control, like physical strength, physical power that humans really can't hope to overwhelm or overcome. And the reason, I think, that so many yokai are translated or called demons is because when these stories first started being heard by missionaries to Japan in the 1500s and 1600s and later on in the 1800s when they started being allowed back into Japan again, that they were seen as kind of demonic sorts of creatures. But they do not map in any way directly to Judeo-Christian monotheistic senses of angels, demons, God, devil sort of thing. So it's really, that's why I don't like using words like demon to
they're weighted. They have a lot of weight and they mean something very different over here. Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for clarifying that. That's a really important distinction.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting things about Japanese folklore is that it doesn't map at all to our conceptions of good, evil, heaven, hell, God, devil, that sort of thing.
Yeah, in fact, there is an idiom in Japanese called said "kokoro oni ni suru."
Make your heart an oni.
Yeah, make your heart oni. What it means is that when you do something right, sometimes you have to make a harsh decision, even though you don't want to do it, but in order to do the right thing, you have to do harsh. We have to make a harsh decision, and so that right there, so Oni is not demon. It's obviously what the EDM is saying is that try make your heart like a demon. No, it just make your heart strong, and that's what Oni means in Japanese. It's powerful, strong, and beyond the human capability.
Exactly. We actually don't cover Oni in Yokai Attack because we don't. Feel that they are yokai. They're actually, we cover them in Yurei Attack, the sequel to Yokai Attack, which is all about ghosts because they are associated with the Japanese underworld so intimately, and they're sort of their own existence in folklore, so to speak.
In my research, I'd come across the kappa, the water spirits or sprites before, but I learned something new in your book, and that is apparently, unless I'm mistaken, they have a particularly pungent flatulence. So here's my question. If if you were walking, say, a river or a stream on, you know, a Sunday afternoon, and a kappa suddenly jumped out and held you down and farted in your face, what would it smell like?
Boy, this is really, this is starting to sound like these conversations that Japanese elementary schoolers have. No, maybe it smells like swamp gas, but there's a very famous story called the Mito incident where a bunch of fishermen caught a kappa, and when it farted, it sickened them. They actually couldn't even breathe. It was that bad. So, I don't know, man.
And also, they usually have three holes.
Yes, three anuses.
Three ani. That's cool.
There's a word you don't usually have to pluralize, huh? Actually, you know, and this is another example of how yokai are part and parcel of Japanese culture. There's actually a saying, he no kappa, in Japanese, he no kappa, which means like a kappa's fart, which is used in Japanese in the way we use, hey, piece of cake, really easy. So it's as easy as a
okay, that's awesome.
Everybody understands that. That's a very, you know, it has roots like that go way back. And maybe it's not one you want to use in polite company, but it is certainly one you would use among your friends.
Nice.
I will need to start using that. Like a kappa's fart, man. Come on.
We've talked about a few of the yokai here. Let's talk about your book a little bit. It's structured with a nice introduction, and then you go through various yokai and talk about what their characteristics are, if they attack you, what it's like, and then what to do to protect yourself. And then there's a little additional trivia about them. How did you classify the yokai and break them up? How did you come to those classifications?
Well, in traditional Japanese yokai studies, if you want to call it that, yokai are usually classified by where they appear, such as in temples or at rivers or at mountains and things like that, which makes a lot of sense to Japanese people who are already really familiar with what the yokai are. But we felt that it would be a little bit complicated for people who weren't. So we decided to organize them by personality. Are they violent? Are they quiet? Are they helpful? Are they wimpy? Do they have a more female form or a more animal-like form? Things that people would probably see and immediately kind of associate with them.
And another thing we made sure for this book is to make sure to cover the major yokai so that readers can communicate or can have fun with Japanese people, especially the ones that, you know, we covered in the very beginning, kappa and tengu, zasuki warashi. Those guys
are tanuki,
and those guys are major league. So to speak.
Yeah, class. Yeah, AAA stars of the yokai world.
Yeah, so we made sure to cover the big guys too.
I'm sort of thinking of the dichotomies between sort of Japanese yokai and Western monsters, one thing that jumps out at me is that typically in Western monsters, the monsters tend to be singular. They tend to be loners. For example, the chupacabra or the Bigfoot or the Mothman or whatever else. And they're sort of in their own little worlds. You don't really have stories about Mothmen, you know, hanging out with Bigfoot or lake monsters. So I'm wondering in the yokai arena, do they know each other? Is there a community of them? Like, for example, with the genies and the djinn, because the djinn are supposed to have their own sort of separate communities, or do they sort of interact, or are they just sort of thought as being sort of singular within each realm?
Mostly are, I think, standalone, but some are married couple.
Yeah, I mean, there are yokai that have relationships with each other. And, like, the question is whether, is there like a yokai realm beyond our understanding? I think generally, yes, in folklore, but, you know, and there's plenty of movies that portray, you know, just beyond, you know, human ability to see or just beyond human understanding is this place where all the yokai kind of live together. But you got to remember that yokai are basically the yokai lore are cobbled together from local and regional and individual people's stories. And so there isn't really any overarching mythology to them other than the animism. Other than that sort of thing that we talked about at the very beginning of the program.
Okay, but so are they? I guess one thing I'm getting at is, are they thought or said to interact with each other in addition to humans? I mean, for example, are there battles as there might be among demigods in Norse mythology or Greek mythology? Or are they sort of is it basically a one-to-one human yokai interaction?
As much as we love the movie The Great Yokai War, both the 1960s version and the early 2000s version by Takashi Miike. As much as we love those films, those are basically the Japanese equivalent of Hollywood. They are not, I don't think, really based in any kind of specific folklore. Although there is a very famous story called the Hyaki Yagyo, which is called the Demon's Night Parade, or the Parade of 100 Demons, depending on who's translating it, that is a supposedly true incident over 1,000 years ago when an army of yokai marched on Kyoto and actually marched along the edge of the city in a kind of show of force to be like, we're out here, people. We're out here, you know. They didn't invade the city. They kind of marched along one edge of it, which apparently struck terror into the hearts of the citizens. And that Demon's Night Parade is an example of many yokai banding together to torture people. It's probably the only real incident that I can think of in Japanese folklore like that.
Okay.
Yeah. The Demon's Night Parade.
That sounds cool.
It's one of those difficult to translate things because they aren't demons in that sense. It's hyaki, and that ki is oni. Back in time, the word yokai is actually fairly recent.
The word
yokai is fairly recent. Words like mononoke, which we talked about earlier, or obake, bakemono,
oni
were used to refer to these creatures. And actually, that's one of the reasons why there are so few, I think, texts on yokai in English, because it's very difficult to kind of categorize them. And that's what we set out to do with our book.
So when you want to go back and do monster research in Japan, I don't want to sound like an idiot, but so the written language it's kanji, is that right?
Kanji and hiragana and katakana. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so has that changed a lot? So if you want to read stuff from 200 or 300 years ago, is it the same character sets, or is it fairly easy for you to read them? Or do you have to read newer material that references the older material? How does that work?
The words, the written characters are changed so much.
Oh boy, okay.
I could read it easily. Yeah. So we have to go through the new version.
Reinterpretation,
yes.
And actually, it's interesting because the Japanese written language has changed far more dramatically in the last 300 to 400 years than written English has. We can go back and we can read a Shakespearean sonnet or a Shakespearean play without too much difficulty. I mean, he has some turns of phrase and words in there that we're not familiar with, but a woodblock print from the late 1800s, those are written using a script called, in a different script, and they are almost impossible for non-experts to read now. And it's really interesting because woodblock prints are sort of precursors to manga and comic books, and that they were made for the people. They were made for everybody to read back at the time. And now, and Japan's level of education is very high. This isn't like an illiteracy problem.
It's just different.
It's changed so much that you can't understand it anymore. So yes, you have to go back to modern day. There are books in Japan that are essentially translations, at least textually, of these older books like Genji Monogatari, The Tale of Genji, or many other books that can't really easily be read by Japanese today.
Wow, I wonder if Google's aware of this. I'm loving their Google Translate and Google Books and some of the stuff for research purposes on English books. I can go back really far. But I had to do some research for another project I'm working on recently, and I was going back to German texts. I literally couldn't read the German at all. I mean, not just to like make it out, but I couldn't read the characters that I didn't understand what I was seeing exactly. The font was just not very much like what I expected. But, you know, exactly like you were saying, though, the old Shakespeare, you know, the F and the S kind of get confusing sometimes. But otherwise, it's pretty straightforward. So I applaud you for slogging through what you had to do, because there's a lot of great content here.
Thank you, Hiroko. Hiroko is the master. Hiroko is the master researcher over here. I mean, I speak and read Japanese, but when you start, I mean, imagine trying to read Shakespeare as a second language. I mean, it's a real slog. So Hiroko is really the engine behind that in our partnership.
Oh,
Well, it pays off. It's really good content. So,
why do you think that Japan has such a rich history of monsters? Obviously, virtually all cultures around the world have some sort of regional or local monsters. But it seems that Japan is really overrepresented between Godzilla and the yokai. And just what is it about the traditions that have spawned so many of these monsters?
Just something about Japan, isn't there? No, it's actually it's a really interesting question because, you know, as you well know, people all over the world, civilizations have always had supernatural explanations for things that they don't understand in the world around them. That's not unique to Japan at all. I think we can all agree with that. But what is unique to Japan is that they created characters out of these explanations. They put faces on them. They gave them bodies and descriptions. And that is exactly why that Hiroko and I strongly feel that the yokai are the precursors to all modern Japanese characters and mascots that we know so well. There's a little bit of yokai DNA in Hello Kitty. There's a lot of yokai DNA in there's quite a bit in Godzilla and things like that as well. And it's not direct, but there's absolutely a sort of lineage there. And yokai are an example of why your real question comes down to, why are Japanese people so great at creating characters? It's this tiny country in Asia, but yet, like, its characters are known all around the world, not just in Asia, Europe and America, you know, South America, North America, everywhere. And it's kind of a testament to that character creation sense that Japan has had for a long time. And the yokai are one example of that.
Obviously, we're at the end of our hour here, but we try to ask every time we have an interview now, we try to ask our guests what your favorite monster is. And I know you guys have been exposed to a lot of them. So Hiroko first, what's your favorite monster?
My favorite monster is Kutsutake Onna.
The slash
mouth woman. I lived with it when I was in elementary school. I discussed passionately how to survive from her attack. And so I really cherish the memory. So my favorite woman, yokai, is slash mouth woman, Kutsutake Onna.
You know, I grew up on things like Godzilla movies and stuff like that. So I really love that kind of thing. But in the yokai realm, my absolute favorite yokai is one called the Tofu Kozo, Tofu Boy. He's this little boy just walking around with a plate of tofu. That's all he is.
It's horrifying.
I just crap my pants.
Perfect example to me of how not all yokai are scary or dangerous or even really frightening. You know, he's just he's a little boy dressed in traditional kimono. Walking around with a plate of tofu. And, you know, the other reason that I love him so much is because look at what we're doing right now. You know, these yokai talks always start out with people kind of being really serious about dangerous and scary ones. And they inevitably end with people laughing together at how crazy the yokai are. And I think that shows the sense of humor that, you know, Japanese people even hundreds of years ago had about the world around them.
Yeah, the one that got me out of the book was the Ashiari Yashiki, the giant. What? It's just a giant foot that comes through your ceiling and demands that you clean it.
What? You know, I actually kind of want to run into that guy. You know,
it's very Monty Python.
It is very Monty Python. Exactly. That's exactly. Only it's disgusting, right? That's amazing. Anyway, this is a fantastic book. Normally we ask our readers to give it a check. I demand everyone get a copy of this. We'll have to have you back to talk about your eye attack at some point.
Anytime.
Okay.
Yeah, great talking to you guys. You guys really are really great. Nice to hear your side on.
You guys are my favorite podcast. Seriously. Thank you.
Thank you. And you guys have a great evening or morning or whatever it is. Time's too complicated for me.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You've just heard an interview with Matt Ault and Hiroko Yoda about the Japanese folklore monsters known as yokai. I'm Blake Smith, and my co-host for this episode was Ben Radford. Monster Talk is produced with the help of Skeptic Magazine. If you're flying to Japan, why not take a copy of Skeptic Magazine? It's better reading material than SkyMall and won't break your bank account. The opinions expressed on Monster Talk are those of the hosts, the guests, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. If you enjoy Monster Talk, why not contribute a dollar or two to our transcription project? The donate link is on our website at monstertalk.org, down at the bottom. Oh, keep scrolling, all the way down. There it is. Click there. Thanks for your support. Thanks to recent support from Wes Adams, Justin Robertson, and Robert Smith. We appreciate it. Monster Talk is rebroadcast in Michigan and parts of Canada on the AM radio. If you're involved in college radio, feel free to share our show. It's released with a Creative Commons license. Intro music to this episode was by Irokaz. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
For more skepticism? Want to learn the truth about the scientific controversies of our time? Then subscribe to Skeptic, the quarterly magazine Stephen Jay Gould called the best journal in the field. To subscribe, visit skeptic.com today.
We doing nude today?
No, I just, I got, see, I got pants on.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.